From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 6th day of July 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. And Harry Cooney today will join us to take up the agricultural energy markets. Don Day will be here to look at the agricultural weather forecast in about 26 minutes. And then in the second half of our program, on many of these radio stations and always online at willag.org, we'll talk with food microbiologist Bob Brackett about food safety in the United States. And it all happens right here on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. Hey, and don't forget that Jim Bauer will be here too during the first half hour of the program. Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago on this Tuesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. Nearby July wheat at 492 and three quarters, the harvest month a nickel higher. September at 507 and a half, up 4 and a half, and December at 535 and a half, up 6 1/2 cents. Hard red July wheat at 512 and three quarters, up 5 and a half from Kansas City. Back in Chicago in the corn pit, nearby July, $3.60, the lead option down 4 cents for the corn. September at 368, 4 and a half lower. December at 379 and a quarter, down 5 and a quarter. And the March futures at 391 and three quarters, down 4 3/4. May corn 399 and three quarters, down 4 1/2 cents. July of next year at 407, down 4 cents on the day. July beans 964 and a quarter, a penny and a half higher. Then comes the red, the August down 4 cents at 940 and a half. September beans at 912 and a half, down 3 3/4. The harvest month November at $9 even, down 5 3/4. And January soybeans at 908 and a half, down 6 1/4. July oats at 248, 5 cents higher. July bean meal at 297, 20 up 230. July bean oil at 35.84, down 17 on the afternoon. Live cattle futures August contract $89.80, up 32.5. August feeders at 113.52.5, up 85 cents. And July lean hogs today settled at $78.75, 77.5 cents that is, up 57.5 cents. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures nearby August contract, $71.94 a barrel, down 19 cents. Ethanol at $1.55, a half cent higher. Natural gas at 4.69 and a tenth, up 0.4 cents. Diesel fuel, 0.4 cents higher as well, at $1.91 9/10 in the August. And the gold futures at $1,194.80 an ounce on a settlement price, down $12.60. The Dow Jones Industrial Average now just about 33 points higher at 97.19. And the U.S. dollar at 84.07 is down 0.53 for the day. Here's what the weather forecast looks like for the two-state region. Dryness becoming more significant from southeastern Missouri to Kentucky, including the southernmost parts of Illinois and the southwestern parts of Indiana, says Drew Lerner. Topsoil firms up in most of the eastern Midwest during the holiday weekend, but subsoil moisture is still favorable across most areas of the Midwest. Excessive rainfall in eastern Iowa during the weekend caused some more flooding. Showers and thunderstorms will remain most concentrated in Missouri and Iowa the next day or two, with some showers expected in northern and western Illinois. Rain most likely in central and eastern parts of the Midwest Thursday into Friday, with rainfall amounts from 0.25 to 0.8 inches. Some local totals may be higher. We'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour. We'll be joined at that time by Drew Lerner of World Weather, rather by Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. This is the closing market report.
Leeson services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
On a Tuesday afternoon, time to check the agricultural futures markets. Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana, is with us. Good afternoon to you, Wayne.
Oh, good afternoon, Todd.
It's the first trading day after what most believe to be the pivotal July 4 time frame. What do we know? Anything more than we knew Friday?
What we know is that we started out with a bang from the 4th of July holiday. In the overnight, we started out lower. We come up closed higher, and we had the enthusiasm of the wheat market that was joined by the European stock market overnight, and the outlook for the Dow Jones to open quite a bit higher. The crude oil trading a lot higher at the open this morning, and the dollar trading about 70 cents lower when we opened. And we opened higher, but couldn't hold, Todd. So we saw a reversal down today.
Yeah, tell me about the enthusiasm in the wheat market. This mostly has to do with spring wheat?
Mainly with the spring wheat. It come out of the French Miller's wheat market, where they'd been up sharply because of the reduction, because of all the hot, dry weather in Europe. Of course, we've seen the Russian crop cut back, Australian crop cut back a little bit, and then trouble in Europe. Also in the shortness of supply in the French market there. So that had bit that along with the extremely short position of the fund traders here in Chicago, they spilled into the Chicago market at the end of last week and, of course, again today quite heavily. So that along with the, heavy short covering by some of our funds here added to where the strength was coming out of the wheat market.
And what do you think farmers are telling you, actually? What do you think farmers are telling? What are farmers telling you about their corn and the bean crop? Have things started to look better for them at this point?
I think it depends on what area of the U.S. you're in, Todd. I've got customers that say their stuff looks a lot better after we had some dry weather for a week, especially over here. We've seen a lot of crops get a lot greener and look a lot better, but we're somewhat in a garden area in comparison. I was talking to an insurance adjuster today that was going up to look at some replanter on Muncie, Indiana, and he said, "Ooh, it looks sick." Talked to another guy that had been through eastern Iowa and said never seen it look better. And we go to western Iowa and eastern Nebraska, and there's areas out there that do not look happy. So, we've got a real mixture of things as far as areas, and I think where it's good, it's real good, and where it's bad, they've got some real problems.
And farmers, I suppose, at this point, are caught between a rock and a hard place. They're wondering, really, whether the December contract, while it's down 5.25 at 379.25, represents a spot that they need to market some corn. Do you think that's the case?
Well, I think there's a lot of people caught in that conundrum here. They sort of felt, and especially after the way they opened this morning, that $4 was an easy shot away. And I know there's a lot of technical traders that were looking and still feel there's a chance at $4. And, they hate to give up and sell 25 cents under that. But on the other hand of things, this report coming out Friday is going to give us an indication of what the USDA is thinking. We generally, one of the things that we don't have in general is them changing the production figure, because they generally don't change that until they actually have a survey out there, which they haven't had, the infield survey trying to guesstimate yields. But we will have, we will see the reduction, the numbers on the planted acres and in the carry-in, because the carry-out will be reduced because of the way they reduced the last year's crop by the feed usage and ethanol usage.
How about on soybeans? Do we need to be doing anything at this time?
Well, I think, $9 is where we closed. $9 has been, a bellwether spot to look at here. We've sold beans more 50 cents to a dollar above here a lot more aggressively, so we're just sort of sitting tight right in here.
Anything else to add before I let you go?
Watch the weather forecasts and see, because it's going to be very important. This corn crop does need about two more weeks of rains to get through, even if we do have other good conditions.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Wayne Nelson is with L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Tuesday afternoon. If you'd like to hear what Wayne had to say again, you can always do that in a couple of ways. You can hear us on the radio station. You can hear us on the web at willag.org. You can do that live if you'd like. That's up at the top of the page, and just hit listen live. Otherwise, you can scroll down the page, look for the Closing Market Report, and listen to it in archive anytime you'd like. There's a way to have it plugged into your iTunes account as well and have a podcast delivered to you. It's all for free, and it's all right there at willag.org. And you could also dial this number, 217-333-3434. That's 217-333-3434. We call it our mobile analyst portal and post an update of either the opening or the closing numbers from the CME Group, along with a bit of analysis. That happens at 10:15 and 3:15 daily. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media on this Tuesday afternoon, the sixth day of July.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Jim Bauer of Bauer Trading out of Lafayette, Indiana, is on the phone line with us today to take up a larger view of the marketplace. Mr. Bauer, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule.
I'm glad to try to help.
Let's start with the economy overall. How do you view it? It seems awfully confusing.
That's correct. I see a lot of investors really on the sidelines right now. A lot of people who have had a lot of experience trading the markets are really, in my opinion, somewhat confused, and they're drawing back. The Dow Jones up until today had been down, I think, seven trading sessions in a row. We've seen some stability develop here over the weekend with EU ministers basically indicating that they're going to follow through with the stress tests for their banks. Of course, you know, the outcome of those stress tests is still unknown. I don't think they're really going to know until about July 23rd. And even then, are they going to be totally accurate and valid? And the whole European situation seems to be on a theme of austerity, while here in the United States, it appears to me anyway, the United States has taken a different approach. They want to try to grow our way out of recession or out of what's been a pretty big slowdown anyway in our domestic economy. So it's kind of like two bulls facing off one another, and I'm not sure which one's going to be able to push the hardest or push one off the cliff, but right now we're kind of head-to-head with the situation in Europe.
And then turn your attention to the wheat market. It has had a strong rally, 1, 2, 3, and if today ends higher, 4 days in a row.
I've been trading wheat a long time, and the wheat is really a market that you really have to look at it from many cross angles. It has a very broad dimension to it because it's very, very global in structure and supply-demand oriented. We've seen relatively optimal yields coming off these combines in Kansas and Oklahoma, at least so far. There's been a few quality issues due to too much rain. But globally, we're seeing some situations which are now indicating that the global stocks of wheat are now in the process of declining. We're seeing a pretty severe situation that has developed in Kazakhstan and parts of southern Russia, a lot of it in the spring wheat and sunseed area, and there's been some significant heat and drought in that part of the world, and they're starting to draw their stocks and their estimate of their crop significantly lower, particularly if they don't get rain and some milder, cooler temperatures here over the next 2 or 3 weeks, and especially in that spring wheat has got to be watched. Then you stem over towards Germany, France, and Spain. Now, all of a sudden, they're starting to dry out and getting into some situations, particularly Germany, and that's got to be watched. And, of course, we already have a situation in Canada in the far northern tier of counties in the northern plains where some of the spring wheat did not get planted. So there was a lot of negative attitude. The S&D table on wheat still is somewhat burdensome But the market is now starting to recognize that from a global standpoint, the stocks are starting to come down now.
By class, does this really make very much difference to the wheat market in total? For instance, is spring wheat a very large class of wheat? I was thinking probably not.
I think the interesting thing about wheat right now is I think the funds were heavily short that wheat market, particularly the Kansas City contract, and we're seeing some significant short covering there. Now, has the fundamentals in wheat really changed that much? Probably domestically not that much. You still are seeing a very, very negative basis, particularly on hard red winter wheat. I think this morning it was $1.29 negative. So my advice to a producer with that kind of structure, from a cash standpoint, I would look to go to the board and sell the board, store, and then wait till we get some kind of basis improvement. Because at minus $1.29, to me, that's pretty prohibitive to be making sales. As far as spring wheat, I want to remind everybody that spring wheat, as evidenced by what happened here a couple of years ago, is a very, very inelastic commodity. And what I mean by that is no matter what the price, the demand must be met. So from a global standpoint, and again, we've got problems in Russia, former Soviet Union, and particularly Kazakhstan. You've got Germany, France, and Spain, and, of course, the situation in Canada. All three of those combined, if the weather starts turning adverse, particularly during the last 2 weeks of July and the first 2 weeks of August, when a lot of that crop potential is really being developed, then we could have a different situation. But wheat's trying to tell us, still somewhat of a negative S&D table, but it's starting to change a little bit on a global scale.
Okay, and then how does that work into the, particularly the corn and maybe the oil seeds?
I think some of our meteorologists missed this forecast here over this past weekend. I don't think very few, if any, were really expecting to see the heat in the southeast and the eastern 25% of the United States like we did. There was a lot of records broken in that far eastern part of the country. Now, of course, that's not where the major production of corn and soybeans are really held. We all know that it's held in the Midwest, but if that particular heat mass would have been over to the west about 400 or 500 miles, we might have had a little different scenario. But that didn't happen, so the market's struggling here a little bit. Corn's only up about 2.5 cents. Wheat's up about 13 to 14 right now. I think wheat's probably trying to hold corn up a little bit. It is important, though, particularly here in the eastern belt, that we do receive some rain here sometime this week, or at least over the weekend. There's two systems that are supposed to come through and give us that rain, because those temperatures that have been running in that 88 to about 94 degree range over the last 5 or 6 days have really started to dry things out pretty readily. You can see that on the lawns already. But the market does expect those rains to come, but if they don't, then of course next week the market will have a different reaction to this whole price discovery.
July 4th as a weekend or a holiday tends to be a transitional point in the marketplace. Can you see any transition taking place?
I think that's correct. I think the transition, if you're just to ask me straight up, I think the transition is we're a little less sure of the weather pattern than we say we were before the 4th of July. In other words, as I indicated earlier, I think it's really important that we get, you know, broad coverage and general rains over that eastern half of the Corn Belt, because we're going to need it. Now, again, if we don't, and we've made a kind of a transitional change in this, with these rains don't develop, then we could have a different structure, because, as you know, corn has a difficult time pollinating when it gets above 95 degrees.
Anything else to add before I let you go today, Jim?
I think. Again, if you're a cash marketer, I think you want to look at probably looking at opportunities depending upon the quality and condition and confidence that you have in this year's crop. Maybe look to make some sales on the board, and then if this basis level will improve, then you know, play that basis level for your cash delivery. But I like leaving these delivery points as open as possible, particularly for Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio. We've really got some situations that have developed over the last year where by using the board you can keep your delivery points much more flexible and play that basis thing. We've got some clients that have done a good job with that, and they picked up some extra money by just really making a strong emphasis on watching the basis and taking advantage of when it improves.
Are you talking on grains and oil seeds both, so wheat, corn, and soybeans?
Particularly some situations in corn in certain locations, and then beans in general, if you're willing to be patient with it and watch it, we've seen some good improvement in basis levels and some pretty strong bids which were not evident just, you know, 60 days ago.
Mr. Bauer, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Jim Bauer is with Bauer Trading Company out of Lafayette, Indiana. I talked to him a bit earlier today at his office there. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Time now to check in on the agricultural energy markets. Harry Cooney of GrowMark is on the phone line with us from his Bloomington, Illinois office. Thanks for joining us today, Harry.
Good afternoon, Todd. Kind of a hot one out there,
it
huh?
It is a kind of a hot one out there. And I suppose maybe we ought to check some of the hot things that are happening. Energy trends and charts are kind of hot lately. What do you see there?
Well, that's right. We came out of the three-day holiday weekend with kind of a bang after all the firecrackers went off at the celebrations this weekend. We kind of had a bang on the markets, and we were up more than a dollar in crude oil this morning. We really had the bulls running the show, and the gasoline and heating oil markets, the diesel fuel markets, were up 5 to 6 cents. They turned around at midday and actually came down and closed unchanged to slightly lower. We continue to have this pull in the markets from the equity markets, like the stock market. And when the stock market is up, energy traders are buying, and when the stock market turns around and goes down, energy traders are selling. And this has been the pattern for the last several months, as the energy traders see the stock market as a good barometer of strength or weakness in the U.S. economy. And the stock market's been selling off here over the past couple of months or so in here, and so thus we had the sell-off in the crude oil market after topping about $87 here back in late April and early May. Crude oil sold off in the 60s, rallied a little bit up into the upper 70s here by the end of June. But now last week was down almost every day. And like I say, we started out this day on the plus side in a big way, but then we came back down and closed about unchanged or lower. So some of that is coming from the stock market, which is back to about unchanged to a little lower here too. So we're having a hard time breaking away from that action in the equities.
Producers in the Midwest can get an idea at this point, a small idea of how much crop they think they'll have in the field, and that'll have some impact on how much fuel they think they will need to have on hand
right
this fall. Should they begin taking a look at pricing some of that out?
We think they probably should start getting an idea and get their numbers in line. If they see some numbers out there when they talk to their local FS member companies, talk to their member company, see what programs they offer, see what prices they're currently being offered in the contract markets out there. If they have some numbers that they like and they can make money at that, or there's some trigger levels that they want to lock in, go ahead and do some locking in. However, if people come to us and they say, hey, just if you look at the market as a whole, should we be buying or should we be selling in here? We're taking a little slower stance at it this year than we have at other years. We still see some of this economic weakness out there and definitely getting into some of these markets. We had the crude oil from a high of 147 a couple of years ago go all the way down to 33. So here in the $70 to $80 range, we're kind of just in the middle. It's not any great buy at all. It's better than what it has been in some past years. So we're taking a little slower approach to it here this year in the contracting.
Harry, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Harry Cooney is with GrowMark, joins us from his Bloomington, Illinois office. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. We'll return in just a couple minutes when we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast with Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Here's something of interest from the University of Illinois.
According to a University of Illinois study, omega-3 fatty acids may be good for more than heart health.
A little-known omega-3 may have implications for treating male infertility. In the experiment, knockout mice that lacked the gene responsible for an enzyme important in making an acid known as DHA were used. In the absence of DHA, male mice are basically infertile, producing few, if any, misshapen sperm that can't get where they need to go, said Manabu Nakamura, a U of I professor of food science and human nutrition. The scientists looked at sperm count, shape, and motility, and tested the breeding success rate, and the mice lacking DHA simply were not able to breed. But when DHA was introduced into the diet, fertility was completely restored. Nakamura said it was very striking. When they fed the mice DHA, all these abnormalities were prevented, and that's something of interest from the University of Illinois.
Something of Interest is a public service of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois.
This is Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report on a Tuesday afternoon. Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, with us now to take up the agricultural weather forecast. Don, how are you today?
I'm doing good.
How about the weather forecast? Is it doing well, too?
Well, we are certainly looking at a lot of hot weather making headlines across many sections of the central and eastern areas of the U.S. right now. And we're looking at that probably continuing for a couple of more days, some very warm temperatures. But we do see a little bit of a cooling trend, and there's going to be ample opportunity for shower and thunderstorm activity to occasionally move across the Midwest, the Corn Belt region, along with temperatures that are going to be a little bit cooler. We don't see one system in particular, but we see several small ones, and this will keep the chances for precipitation fairly frequent.
Ample opportunity. How much rainfall might come along with it, and how widespread?
Well, I think the coverage, when you add up all of these systems, is going to be pretty good. I would say 100% in terms of the Corn Belt getting rained on. Just about everybody will. The areas that are going to be most impacted will probably be the northern and western areas, central and northwestern Illinois, Iowa. Those areas are looking at picking up as much as 2 to 4 inches of rain over the next 5 to 7 days, with other areas picking up about 1 to 2.
And what kind of temperatures are we talking about through that process? We are in the middle of pollination.
Yeah, well, we're going to be, is at least the hottest weather comes in the short term. We're looking at temperatures that are going to be 80s and 90s across many areas and cooling down a little bit towards next week.
And then if you look further out, do the rainfall continue as we get into the month of July? And we're still flowering soybeans, but eventually we'll need rain for that crop.
Well, it looks like the highest probabilities of rain will be between where we are right now and next Wednesday. After that, rain chances still remain, but they're going to taper off some. I don't see any prolonged period of dry weather setting up for the middle of the month.
Let's move around the other side of the world and talk just a bit about the Chinese growing areas, in particular the northeastern part of that nation, or the Corn Belt there.
Well, wet. It looks like, especially in the short term, many areas of east, central, and northeast areas of China looking at some very good chances for precipitation. A pretty active pattern in China right now, so odds are that many areas will see good chances of rain, in some areas quite a bit.
And their temperatures?
Below normal. There will be some areas in north, central, and northwest China that will be on the warm side, but the rest of that nation, temperatures on the whole over the next 7 to 10 days will be averaging below normal.
Thank you so much. Any other spots around the nation or the globe that we really need to take a look at before I let you go?
Don't think so. We're certainly seeing the tropical activity pick up, and we will keep an eye on the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico for possibly more tropical activity developing in the next couple of weeks.
And that's Don Day. He's with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report each and every Tuesday afternoon. Stay with us if you can for the farming world. If not, you can always listen to it online at willag.org. That's willag.org. You have a great afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Robert Brackett, a food microbiologist, about a just-released IOM, that's an Institute of Medicine report. It's titled Enhancing Food Safety, the Role of the Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA. We're going to talk about food safety with Mr. Brackett, and thank you so much for joining us from your Washington office, I suppose, on this particular day, which is the 30th day of June on the recording. It's your last day with the Grocery Manufacturers Association. You're moving back to Chicago, is that right?
Yes, I will be moving to Chicago for a new position. I'll be co-located here in D.C. as well at the Illinois Institute of Technology's National Center for Food Safety and Technology, which happens to be in Summit, Argo.
Let's start and talk about this report from the IOM. Why was there a need to do such a report on food safety and the role of the Food and Drug Administration?
Well, I think part of it's really prompted by some of the food safety issues that have been quite apparent in the last decade in particular, and also the fact that there have been a number of changes with food and with the food system globally, really. And that is that we are sourcing more foods from abroad, for a wider variety of types of foods. And at the same time, we've had an agency who is responsible for 80% of the food supply, that being the Food and Drug Administration, being stretched thinner and thinner in how they regulate and enforce the laws for foods. And so it was time to really look and help FDA to try to figure out how they could do things better going forward.
I suppose you had to first learn the division of labor between USDA APHIS and the FDA. Is that right?
Well, there is. And there are a number of different agencies that have some part in food safety. USDA and FDA are the primary agencies. The best way to think about this is that USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service really is responsible for meats, poultries, and some egg products. Everything else that you can think of goes to FDA. So that means not only dairy products, but also grains or processed foods, canned foods, fishery products, with the exception of catfish now. Everything else goes to FDA. And so I think part of the concern, and this has been stated numerous times over the last decade or so, is that it's a situation where you've got the agency who is responsible for 80% of the food supply actually being funded more like 20% just by virtue of the way the statutes are written.
Yes, and so USDA's APHIS, that's the Animal Plant and Health Inspection Service, takes care of part of the job of inspection on site, for instance, in a meatpacking plant, and FDA takes care of the other part of the job. But as you look at it, when you started to look at the system, what did you find, and where are the flaws?
Well, it isn't so much a flaw as the fact that, as I mentioned, the Food and Drug Administration has been stretched very thin. They have been in a posture where, as the food safety issues have arisen, they've been in a very reactive mode. That is, sort of chasing fires, if you will. Whenever an outbreak or a recall happens, they're quick to go try to do something about that. But they've really not had the opportunity to sort of step back and rethink about how they're going about doing this. So really what the report emphasizes is really six major parts, and that is the need for FDA to do a much better job at strategic planning, finding out where they're going and how they're going to do that. Getting a better handle on ranking the risks that they deal with so that they're not chasing issues that are of lower public health risks, targeting more information on that risks, and then looking to see what interventions both the agency as well as the food industry, who really is ultimately responsible for the safety, needs to employ to improve the food safety, and then go back and see if they're actually doing the job that they can through monitoring and review. to see if they are actually reducing the disease burden for foods in this country.
Is this what you call the decision-making approach, a risk-based decision-making approach for food safety?
Well, that is an important part of it. The first part is actually understanding what the risks are, and I think we have a good understanding of that, but perhaps not in as detailed a way that we need to. But then also to have a process, and a very transparent to the public as well as to sister agencies, process for how they are going to manage those risks. First, they have to have the requisite information, and that was part of one of the findings as well, is that quite often they're not able to determine which risks are bigger than others just simply because they don't have the informational needs that are required.
So this is the assessment and the ranking and part of the planning process. Did you come to conclusions about how FDA and U.S. government might be able to do that in a better way?
Well, yes. And again, the whole key here is how do you do this in a proactive, risk-based manner rather than being reactive? And so as part of the strategic planning process, it would identify sort of what the data and research needs are for the risk-based approach, which they're too busy to do right now, and then establish some mechanisms to coordinate and capture and sort of integrate this information and this data. There are also, that we found, some legal, structural, and really cultural barriers to the practical utilization of this data in such a system. And I think there has to be recognition that these barriers do exist, and the agency will have to make recommendations on how to get over those.
What are the risks?
Well, there is different risks. You can have microbiological risk, which really represent the major impact of public health that we have in this country with respect to foods. There are also some chemical risks. Sometimes you have agents in foods that are either directly or indirectly a part of food as a result of packaging. Sometimes these scare a lot of people, but when you look at what the public health impact are, they're minuscule compared to the microbiological risks. There's also the risk of reacting in the wrong way that damages the industry at a time that it's not really correcting what the problem is. And probably the example that best shows this was several years ago when some salmonella cases, or many cases actually, were initially traced to or thought to be caused by tomatoes. And so the agency tried to track that down. The industry was devastated, only to find out that it was actually jalapeno peppers that were the major cause of it. And it's hard to sometimes recover from that. And if the food happens to be the cause of the outbreak, well, then something needs to be done about it. But what you don't want to do is start taking agency, very limited resources, going after something that doesn't really solve the problem and in the meantime damages an industry in the process.
And then you said there were legal and cultural roadblocks to risk assessment as well. What are those?
Well, a lot of it has to do with information sharing. What many people don't realize is that even though FDA appears to be ultimately responsible for regulating the food supply in this country, it's actually the states that do a lot of the inspections and a lot of the oversight. Some of these barriers that we have there, for instance, are barriers to sharing information. So quite often you will have the states having part of the information. The Centers for Disease Control, who are doing surveillance, also have information. You have FDA having information, and in some cases there are legal prohibitions, or at least thought to be legal prohibitions, for them to share that data. And so a lot of time is wasted on these investigations because these three very important partners, the states, the CDC, and the FDA, can't really talk to each other as openly as they would like to.
Did the report make suggestions about how they could do a better job of sharing data?
Well, yeah, we made the point that they needed to share the data. That was critical. One of the recommendations that actually came out of it was to create a sort of a risk, a data warehouse, basically, that all of the information could be fed into, regardless of who the partner is, that would be able to be used by the agency in making decisions.
This sounds like some of the things that USDA has tried to do with traceback, and it's not been particularly successful because there's always somewhere along the line somebody who doesn't want to share the data. Do you think it's really possible to put in place?
Well, I think it has to be. If we're going to have a system where the consumers are going to be protected in the way that they expect to be, there's got to be a better way to share data. If it means that requires some mechanism like commissioning, where people are basically sworn to keep it confidential within the government, then that will have to be done. But you are correct, and that you're talking about one of the cultural differences, that sometimes a group may feel like that they possess that data, that's their data, and they shouldn't be sharing it. But that is counterproductive to public health in this country. Unless it's something that's truly a trade or proprietary piece of information, that doesn't really help with public health. And there is a number of those.
So how do you make the argument that the aggregated data should be public data as opposed to the private data that would go into that aggregated data?
Well, that's a good point. It really wouldn't be public data. It would be put into a cohesive unit, a data analysis system that the regulatory agencies could actually draw from. And some of the information that could go in there actually would be useful to have private sector data in there as well. And the perfect example is surveillance data or research data that perhaps private companies might do on their own. They get findings and results that may be helpful to others, but they don't necessarily want to have their name attached to that. If they could have that anonymously put into this system where the research results or the surveillance results are available, but it's not attributed to any particular country, a company, the agency could then use that to help in their decision making.
Yeah, but on this recommendation, doesn't it mean that you can really trace back a food to a food supplier, to a grower, to a producer at some point, and that's what really needs to be in place?
Well, it depends on the use. Now, you talked about traceback. That's sort of a separate issue, and that's actually a statutory issue that's being proposed now in some of the new legislation, where one would have traceability in the event that there was an issue. What we're really talking about is getting to a point where, first of all, there's information available that would be preventive. That is, it would allow manufacturers and the government to have systems to prevent the contamination in the first place, or at least the live organisms. Having a traceback system is essential, but it's separate from what I'm discussing. And really what we're talking about is creating an integrated information infrastructure. That is a system whereby both the, especially at the federal and the state level, it's information that can be used to make better judgments about where the risks actually occur and how to mitigate those risks. Not so much identifying what one company is doing versus another company, unless it's something like a practice that one company is using that seems to be working in preventative. That's good for them to share for the rest of the with the rest of the industry. We do not believe that food safety should be a competitive issue, and I don't think most food companies do either.
You're listening to The Farming World. Our guest today is Robert Brackett. He is a food microbiologist and helped to author or oversee an Institute of Medicine report entitled Enhancing Food Safety and the Role of the Food and Drug Administration. More with him in a moment.
It's National Fried Chicken Day. Fried chicken dates back to ancient cultures all over the world, including Rome, Egypt, and China. Fried chicken in America has its roots in southern slavery. Fried chicken was often served among slaves on special occasions. It's also National Pickle Festival Day. As early as 1659, Dutch farmers in New York grew cucumbers, which were sold to dealers who cured them in barrels and sold them from market stalls. But it was not until 1820 that pickles were sold commercially in jars. In 1858, lineman Blake patented the first shoe sole machine. His invention revolutionized the shoe industry and made Plymouth County, Massachusetts, the nation's shoe capital. In 1886, Horlicks of Wisconsin offered the first malted milk for sale to the public. Horlicks developed the process to dehydrate milk and patented it in 1883, calling it malted milk. The company originally produced a food for babies and invalids that could be shipped without spoiling. And in 1990, Nathaniel Wyeth died. Wyeth, an American chemist and inventor, received a patent for PET plastic beverage bottles. Those were the first plastic bottles strong enough to hold carbonated beverages that would satisfy food safety requirements. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, our guest is Robert Brackett. He's a food microbiologist and helped to develop a report from the Institute of Medicine. It's called Enhancing Food Safety and the Role of the Food and Drug Administration. We were talking just before the break about risk management. Did you look at benefits, too? And so kind of a cost-benefit analysis of what might need to be done in order for FDA to do a better job of developing the risks that are entangled with the food supply?
Well, unfortunately, no, we didn't. That was actually part of the charge for us to take a look at that. But really, there were not enough of the economic consequences or data that would have allowed us to be able to do something in a meaningful way. So we made sort of broad recommendations. First of all, realizing that changing the food system at FDA is going to take more resources than what they've had up until this time. The benefits to society, we know that reduced foodborne illness is going to have an impact both on the economics of public health, that is, there are fewer people who are ill, who are out of work, to the companies who suffer billions of dollars worth of damage whenever one of their products is implicated in an outbreak. But as far as actually doing an economic risk-based, something we wanted to do, but we just didn't have the needed information to do that.
Did you take up food inspections and how to enhance the efficiencies?
Well, that was part of it, yes. And this goes to the risk-based inspections. And as you mentioned, the Food Safety and Inspection Service at USDA has looked at this as well. In this case, it would be allowing FDA to perhaps better deploy the limited inspectional staff that they have. We had several other recommendations, and one of which was that that the inspectorate of FDA, which is in the Office of Regulatory Affairs, actually be under the direction of the policy unit, which is the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition at FDA, such that they could be more nimble in getting inspectors to where they're needed quicker. And likewise, having inspectors be specialized in inspecting food plants. What many people don't realize is that most FDA inspectors are actually quite well trained, but they do a multiple number of inspections. They will look at drugs one day, and they may look at a food plant the next day and a vaccine plant the following day. So what we're suggesting is that more emphasis for food needs to be put by individual inspectors and having them specialize and only do food.
I'm going to follow along on the report itself and some of the titles of the chapters, Improving Food Safety and Risk Communications. How do you go about doing those things?
Well, that's an important issue, and that we realize that the public is often confused by what they hear. They may hear one thing from FDA, another thing from CDC, and perhaps a third thing from USDA if it happens to be a product where all three groups need to be involved. And I think FDA realizes this, but we wanted to emphasize as well that FDA should be an authoritative body for providing food safety information to the public. We think that they should continue to develop a sort of a single source of authoritative government information on food safety, safe food practices, the foodborne illnesses and risks, and also crisis communications. Quite often, FDA is very good about getting the information out that there's an outbreak or that there's a recall, but it's sort of left that at that point, and it often leaves consumers confused and sort of vulnerable to misinformation by others as well.
How do you deal with imported food products? And there are many of them, usually fruits and some vegetables.
It's a huge issue. The number of imports, food ingredients, and whole foods coming into this country is increasing at a almost logarithmic rate. It's gone up from perhaps 10 years ago, about 5 or 6 million what they call line entries, up to almost 20 today, 20 million. And the unfortunate thing is that the number of inspectors has either not changed during that time to look at imported products, or in some cases at times that's gone down. You've got some foods, such as you mentioned, fruits and vegetables, the majority of which during some seasons comes from abroad, or seafoods, where you may have 80% plus of seafoods coming from abroad. And it gives it makes it very, very difficult for the agency to try to figure out how to cover the waterfront on all of those. So what really needs to be done, again, is this emphasis on prevention and allowing the agency to require companies, whether they be domestic or foreign, to have documented preventive controls in place to allow them to use, again, risk. Here, risk of includes a perhaps country of origin. It may include specific brokers that bring it in who have not had a great record, and allow them to really focus on those products that are of highest risk to public health and not focus so much on products that are of lower risk.
Mr. Brackett, thank you so much for being with us, and good luck in your new job at the Illinois Institute of Technology.
Well, it's my pleasure being with you, and thank you very much.
Bob Brackett is a food microbiologist, and he helped to pen a report from the Institute of Medicine called Enhancing Food Safety, the Role of the Food and Drug Administration. You've been listening to The Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason. You have a good day.
The Closing Market Report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from L&M Commodities, a full-service brokerage company serving area farmers with professional market advice and crop insurance products. L&M Commodities has offices in New Market, Indiana, Leland, Illinois, and Terrell, Arkansas.